royal couple.
You're listening to BBC Radio 4 Extra.
In 1967, a chance meeting between two young people led to a romance and a lifelong friendship that would carry each to international success never dreamed of. Now on 4 Extra, Patti Smith reads from her memoir of her life in New York in the late 60s and 1970s. We begin in 66, and Patti is living in South Jersey with her family and seems destined to become a schoolteacher.
When I was very young, my mother took me for walks in Humboldt Park along the edge of the Prairie River. I have vague memories, like impressions on glass plates, of an old boathouse, a circular bandshell, an arched stone bridge. The narrows of the river emptied into a wide lagoon, and I saw upon its surface a singular miracle. A long, curving neck rose from a dress of white plumage. "Swan," my mother said, sensing my excitement. It pattered the bright water, flapping its great wings and lifted into the sky. The word alone hardly attested to its magnificence, nor conveyed the emotion it produced. The sight of it generated an urge I had no words for, a desire to speak of the swan, to say something of its whiteness, the explosive nature of its movement, and the slow beating of its wings. The swan became one with the sky. I struggled to find words to describe my own sense of it. "Swan," I repeated, not entirely satisfied, and I felt a twinge, a curious yearning, imperceptible to passerby, my mother, the trees, or the clouds.
Jesus died for somebody's sins, but not mine.
When I was a young girl, I fell into trouble. I was dismissed from college. But I knew I was not destined to be a school teacher, though I believed it to be an admirable occupation.
People say, beware.
My compatriot from college, Janet Hamill, bolstered my morale. She had lost her mother and came to stay with my family. Both of us harbored lofty dreams, but also a common love of rock and roll, spending long evenings discoursing on the Beatles versus the Rolling Stones. We had stood in line for hours at Sam Goody's to purchase Blonde on Blonde, combing Philadelphia in the search of a scarf like the one Bob Dylan wore on the cover. We lit candles for him when he had his motorcycle accident. We lay in the high grass listening to Light My Fire, wafting from the radio of Janet's battered car parked by the side of the road with the doors open. We cut our long skirts to the mini lengths of Vanessa Redgrave's and Blow Up and searched for greatcoats in thrift stores like those worn by Oscar Wilde and Baudelaire. On Memorial Day, I took a bus to Philadelphia to visit the Joan of Arc statue near the Museum of Art. How beautiful she looked astride her horse, raising her banner toward the sun, a teenage girl who delivered her imprisoned king to his throne in Rouen, only to be betrayed and burned at the stake. I vowed that I would make something of myself, then headed back home, stopping in Camden at the Goodwill store, by a long gray raincoat.
Hoping you'll come through too.
In the spring of 1967, I assessed my life. I was holding a temporary minimum wage job in a textbook factory in Philadelphia. My immediate concern was where to go next and what to do when I got there. I held to the hope that I was an artist, though I knew I would never be able to afford art school, and I had to make a living. There was nothing to keep me home, no prospects and no sense of community. My parents had raised us in an atmosphere of religious dialogue, of compassion, of civil rights, but the general feel of rural South Jersey was hardly pro-artist. My few comrades had moved to New York to write poetry and study art, and I felt very much alone. I had found solace in Arthur Rimbaud, who I had come upon in a bookstall across from the bus depot in Philadelphia when I was 16. His haughty gaze reached mine from the cover of Illuminations. He possessed an irreverent intelligence that ignited me, and I embraced him as compatriot, kin, and even secret love. Not even having the 99 cents to buy the book, I pocketed it. At the factory where I had labored with a hard-edged, illiterate group of women, I was harassed in his name. Suspecting me of being a communist for reading a book in a foreign language, they threatened me in the John, prodding me to denounce him. It was within this atmosphere that I seethed. It was for him that I wrote and dreamed. The knowledge of him added swagger to my step, and this could not be stripped away. I tossed my copy of Illuminations in a plaid suitcase. We would escape together. I had my plan. I would seek out friends who were studying at the Pratt Institute in Brooklyn. I figured if I placed myself in their environment, I could learn from them. When I was laid off in late June from my job in the textbook factory, I took this as a sign to head out. I had enough money for a one-way ticket. I planned to hit all the bookstores in the city. This seemed ideal work to me. My mother, who is a waitress, gave me white wedgies and a fresh uniform and a plain wrapper. "You'll never make it as a waitress," she said, "but I'll stake you anyway." It was her way of showing her support. At 20 years old, I boarded the bus. I wore my dungarees, black turtleneck, and the old gray raincoat I had bought in Camden. My small suitcase, yellow and red plaid, held some drawing pencils, a notebook, Illuminations, a few pieces of clothing, and pictures of my siblings. I was superstitious. Today was Monday. I was born on Monday. It was a good day to arrive in New York City. No one expected me. Everything awaited me. It was a sunny afternoon. I was hoping my friends might put me up until I could find a place on my own. I went to the brownstone at the address I had, but they had moved. The new tenant was polite. He motioned toward a room at the rear of the flat and suggested his roommate might know the new address. I walked into the room. On a simple iron bed, a boy was sleeping. He was pale and slim, with masses of dark curls, lying bare-chested with strands of beads around his neck. I stood there. He opened his eyes and smiled. When I told him of my plight, he rose in one motion, put on his huaraches and a white t-shirt, and beckoned me to follow him. I watched him as he walked ahead, leading the way with a light-footed gait, slightly bow-legged. I noticed his hands as he tapped his fingers against his thigh. I had never seen anyone like him. He delivered me to another brownstone on Clinton Avenue, gave a little farewell salute, smiled, and was on his way. The day wore on. I waited for my friends. As fortune would have it, they did not return. That night, having nowhere to go, I fell asleep on their red stoop. When I awoke, it was Independence Day, my first away from home with the familiar parade, veterans' picnic, and fireworks display. I felt a restless agitation in the air. Packs of children threw firecrackers that exploded at my feet. I would spend that day, much as I spent the next few weeks, looking for kindred souls, shelter, and most urgently, a job. Summer seemed the wrong time to find a sympathetic student. Everyone was less than eager to provide me with a helping hand. Everyone was struggling, and I, the country mouse, was just an awkward presence. Eventually, I went to the city and slept in Central Park. Along Fifth Avenue, I left applications at shops and bookstores. I would often stop before a grand hotel, an alien observer to the Proustian lifestyle of the privileged class. The city was a real city, shifty and sexual. I was lightly jostled by small herds of flushed young sailors looking for action on 42nd Street, with its rows of X-rated movie houses, brassy women, glittering souvenir shops, and hot dog vendors. I grew more desperate to find a job and started a second-level search in boutiques and department stores. I was quick to comprehend I wasn't dressed right for this line of work. Even Capizio's, a store for classic dance attire, wouldn't take me, though I had cultivated a good beatnik ballet look. I canvassed 60th and Lexington, and as a last resort, left an application at Alexander's, knowing I would never really work there. Then I began to walk downtown, absorbed in my own condition. It was Friday, July 21st, and unexpectedly, I collided with the sorrow of an age. John Coltrane, the man who gave us a love supreme, had died. Scores of people were gathering across from St. Peter's Church to say goodbye. Hours passed. People were sobbing as the love cry of Albert Eiler spirited the atmosphere. It was as if a saint had died, one who had offered up healing music, yet was not permitted to heal himself. Along with many strangers, I experienced a deep sense of loss for a man I had not known save through his music. Later, I walked down Second Avenue, Frank O'Hara territory. Pink light washed over rows of boarded buildings. New York light, the light of the abstract expressionists. I thought Frank would have loved the color of the fading day. Had he lived, he might have written an elegy for John Coltrane like he did for Billie Holiday. I spent the evening checking out the action on St. Mark's Place. Long-haired boys scatting around in striped bell-bottoms and used military jackets, flanked with girls wrapped in tie-dye. There were flyers papering the streets announcing the coming of Paul Butterfield and Country Joe and the Fish. White Rabbit was blaring from the open doors of the Electric Circus. The air was heavy with unstable chemicals, mold, and the earthy stench of hashish. The fat of candles burned, great tears of wax spilling onto the sidewalks. I can't say I fit in, but I felt safe. No one noticed me. I could move freely. There was a roving community of young people, sleeping in the parks, in makeshift tents, the new immigrants invading the East Village. I wasn't kin to these people, but because of the free, floating atmosphere, I could roam within it. I had faith. I sensed no danger in the city, and I never encountered any. I had nothing to offer a thief and didn't fear men on the prowl. I wasn't of interest to anyone, and that worked in my favor for the first few weeks of July when I bummed around, free to explore by day, sleeping where I could at night. I sought doorwells, subway cars, even a graveyard, startled to awake beneath the city sky or being shaken by a strange hand. Time to move along. Time to move along. It was the summer Coltrane died, the summer of Crystal Ship. Flower children raised their empty arms and China exploded the H-bomb. Jimi Hendrix set his guitar in flames in Monterey. AM radio played Ode to Billy Joe. There were riots in Newark, Milwaukee, and Detroit. It was the summer of Elvira Madigan, the summer of love. And in this shifting, inhospitable atmosphere, a chance encounter changed the course of my life. It was the summer I met Robert Mapplethorpe.
Patti Smith was reading from her memoir, Just Kids. It was abridged by Jeremy Osborne, produced by Rosalind Ward, and was a Sweet Talk production for BBC Radio.
BBC Radio 4 Extra.
It's 3 o'clock and we've an hour of drama now, and the last of Thomas Hardy's completed novels. Michael Pennington stars in Jude the Obscure next. And in an hour you can hear Roald Dahl's The Witches, read by Kathy Burke. The 4 o'clock show will also explore the life of the celebrated children's author and the profound influence his early life had on his wicked and wonderful stories. Join Mel in an hour. Now we continue our drama with episode 2 of Jude the Obscure. Jude truly believes that a man of virtue who is willing to apply himself should be awarded privilege.